Good afternoon. Welcome. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
Laureen Jaffe.
And we are glad you are here. Yeah.
That's all I can say. I mean, I feel like last Sunday was an eternity ago. I mean, there's so much that has happened in the world.
Absolutely.
I don't even know where to begin. U.S. elections, Israel elections. But we'll start with AIPAC just because.
Well, let's also say we are live today. We will take calls later on. Okay. All right.
So,
AIPAC.
So yeah. So I know we get a couple. Our fan club of like three or four haters. But, you know, what was interesting, and they always.
Okay. And Laureen went to AIPAC.
Yeah. Went to the policy conference. Mike didn't. But what was interesting, they always call it, you know, some crazy right wing organization. But I will tell you, it was so impressive. There was over 18,000 people there this year, 4,000 plus college students. It is such a slice of the diversity of America. You had people from every religion, every ethnicity, every color, every sexual orientation, everywhere on the political spectrum, participating. And it was and then you had what I thought was most fascinating. So obviously going into the weekend, Bernie Sanders had made a very strong statement that attacked everyone in that room by calling it a racist organization that supported bigotry and bigoted policies. And I thought to myself, if you stood right here, in essence, Bernie Sanders, you were calling the American people racist, because you had, when I look at the diversity and the minority population and just how vast it was, people were so offended of that, and by that, and people who consider themselves lifelong strong Democrats, strong liberals, strong progressives were just furious and offended. And I'll add one more note, Mike, before you come out. But what I thought was most powerful is that you had the Democratic establishment. You had Senator Bob Menendez, the highest ranking Hispanic in Congress. You had Joe Biden. You had Amy Klobuchar. You had Mike Bloomberg. You had Charles Schumer. You had Steny Hoyer, the second highest Democrat in the House. All come out very powerful against Bernie Sanders' statement on against that, and really uniting the Democrats. And I thought, in that sense, I really appreciated that. And I think it was just, again, remembering that you know, it's one of the few issues in Congress as bipartisan.
Here's my take on it. I didn't go. I went last year to cover it, not as a member. It seemed to me to be more Republican-leaning than the entire Jewish population in the country. That's the feel I came away with after attending it last year to cover it as a journalist. It seems to have right now. Do you disagree with me then?
I do, only because I think it always depends on the administration. I think during the Obama administration, you would have said it felt more Democratic-leaning. I think it's because depending on what administration is in power, we always have people from that administration come and speak. Like
the members. I mean, 75% of American Jews are going to vote Democratic. If you go under past practices,
I would say at least half the people, if not more of the people there, were Democrats.
Really? I didn't get that. Last year, the impression I got was that 75% were Republican-leaning. I had some really interesting discussions.
Yeah. Anyway, you may have found the interesting ones, but I mean, most of the people I know there are Democrats, and
really?
They're lifelong Democrats. And I think we all appreciated the Democratic establishment coming out and just really speaking to us and again reassuring that confidence of just the U.S.-Israel relationship and not getting to these partisan battles. But I thought Bloomberg, by the way, gave a phenomenal speech.
Yeah, you told me that. You sent that somewhere.
Right. And of course. By the way, anybody who's listening, if you wanted to, I think all these speeches are available online. You can watch all the videos. And you know who else spoke?
You said Cory Booker was really good.
Cory Booker. Oh, yeah, Cory Booker rocked. I forgot to mention him before. Yeah, Cory Booker just rocked. He was just on fire. He was like, I swear you would thought he was a preacher. He was just so good. Got to see him separately, too, at a reception. Got to meet the president of the Democratic Republic of Congo. He was there. Just such an honor to meet that man. Just, wow, so profound. And he announced that he was moving his country's embassy to Jerusalem. The president of Colombia yeah. was there. I just extraordinary international figures. I also got to meet a Palestinian with the Washington Institute. He and I had a long discussion about some of the issues going on in Gaza right now. A lot of concern about the humanitarian crisis and problems because Hamas is not reinvest into infrastructure, and a lot of concerns about long-term, how do we address the water issues, how do we address the power issues, how do we address sewage issues. So I'm hoping to have him on with us in the near future.
I want to ask you, was there any concern afterwards, because there were some people that were exposed at
right.
the conference?
I saw that, yeah. So
the coronavirus.
So, I guess there was somebody from New York who was in attendance who had been exposed to the coronavirus. And I think there was someone from California who people learned after the fact, after the conference, they had been exposed to coronavirus, and they're now in quarantine. The D.C. Health Department and everyone has come out and said that there's no reason for anyone at the event to be concerned. I'm not concerned.
You're not, okay. You look pretty healthy.
I'm not concerned. But I guess the other thing I wanted to just mention, because it was because it is Women's Month, and so you know me, I'm always watching documentaries, and Mike is the documentary king.
Well, I'm making them, so I don't have as much time to watch them.
Right, exactly. You're busy making them.
Right.
But I just want to highlight this one movie. I wanted to see it for a while, finally came out to rent. It's called The Cave. It is a documentary that was done by the National Geographic on this young woman who had just finished medical school as a pediatrician. Her name, Dr. Amani Balor, who was running, in essence, an underground hospital one of the besieged cities in Syria. For 5 years, Assad Bashar and Russia, you know, through its Russia-backed forces, were just constantly bombing the city. You saw, this was also the city that was hit with two chemical attacks, the first one on the children, the gas, the neurological gas, and then the second, the chlorine attack, and you saw the people come in and the horrific devastation. And this young woman, who you know had to fight against a lot of the religious as well, the religious men who were like, "Hey, women shouldn't be working," but one of the other doctors is like, "Listen, she's running this place.
Right.
She's doing a damn good job. Leave her alone." But how strong she was, and you just saw her making these decisions of life and death, and just literally caring for thousands of people over these 5 years. And
it's called The Cave.
It's called The Cave, and I just got to tell it, this woman is just, she is a hero. She is an absolute hero, and I just encourage everybody. And so I brought it up, and I thought it was really special because if you all remember, about 2 months ago, we had Marco Moreno in. And Marco, with the IDF, ran Operation Good Neighbor, and he did a lot of work with a lot of the Syrian refugees, the civilians who were being attacked by their own government that were coming into Israel for medical treatment, and he helped run that operation. And so I just thought this, you know, it sort of went back to back with that. So, the movie's called The Cave, just phenomenal.
Listen, why don't we do this? This is sort of breaking the format we usually do, but we've got a couple of calls hanging on, and one wants to refute something we said last week, and the critics of our show say we never let anybody refute what we're saying, which is just absolutely not true. But Art from Largo is on the line. Art, you with us?
Yeah, hi. I would like to just clarify what Lauren said on March 1st, that the Romans killed Jesus.
No, I said that.
Pardon?
I said that.
Oh, I stand correct.
Maybe we both agreed, but it was the Romans. You know, my
sources are the Bible. As you know, Pilate, the Jesus went to Pilate, and he said, Pilate said to the plaintiffs, "Take him and judge him according to your law." And the Jews said, "It is not lawful for us to put any man to death." And Pilate then talked with Jesus, and when he returned, he says, he said to them, I find no fault in him. In other words, Pilate tried to defend Jesus at least two, three times. And I get my, as I said, I get my, you surprised me by calling me so soon.
Okay.
Oh, that's okay. What about the Second Vatican?
In the book of the Acts of the Apostle, verses 22-23, the Apostle Peter, who was the first pope that we recognize, when speaking to his fellow Jews, said, quote, ye men of Israel, hear these words, him, meaning Jesus, you have taken and by wicked hands have crucified and slain.
Okay, but wait a second. Loreen just mentioned Vatican II. Wait. Hang on a second. Vatican II.
Right, so in Vatican II, the Pope reversed really what had caused so many of the Inquisitions and anti-Semitism for centuries, a statement of the Catholic Church and said that the Jews weren't responsible for Jesus' death.
Yes, I agree with you.
Okay.
I agree with you, and I join millions of Christians who declare that today's Jews, nor the Jews of the Middle Ages, nor the Jews of the second era, they are responsible for killing Jesus. Okay. I agree with you on that.
Right, thank you, Art, and thank you for calling in.
Thanks for calling, and we want to make sure that everybody gets an opportunity to say whether they agree with us or even disagree with us, and I really appreciate the call, Art. We got to move on because we have a packed show today, but I just wanted to get that in at the top. We were talking about the coronavirus. That is dominating the news worldwide, and obviously in Israel and with the Palestinian Authority.
There are a bunch of Americans quarantined in Bethlehem right now at one of the hotels. And I think the Palestinian Authority has shut down tourism into Bethlehem.
It's like a ghost town there from what I've read.
So there was a group of American tourists that were there. I mean, there were other tourists with them, but they're in quarantine in Bethlehem for 14 days, as well as, like I said, I think Bethlehem, Jericho, I think also Hebron, they shut down tourism.
And Israel is considering quarantining anybody that comes back from the United States.
Right.
This is a serious epidemic that I think we're just seeing the tip of the iceberg. I hope I'm wrong.
You're wrong, too. And you know what is great is that, you know, Israel is getting closer and closer to the vaccine for the coronavirus. It's a couple of positive things that came out. Obviously, the Israeli and the Palestinian Authority, they're working together on joint efforts to counter coronavirus. And I know I've mentioned this before. There's a lot of security negotiation that goes back and forth between both Israel and the Palestinian Authority that you don't hear in the news and the media. But it is there. It is regularly occurring. I thought this was interesting in Iran.
That's right. Did you see the Iran is in turmoil because the coronavirus killed what they called the butcher of Tehran.
The man known as the butcher of Tehran for pretty much he's the guy who is the henchman for killing many of the civilians who have protested against the government over the years. But not just them, but there's like several other high-ranking members of the Iranian government that have also been exposed, as well as members of their parliament. Out of all the countries in the Middle East, Iran has significantly the highest number of cases of the coronavirus right now. But I thought was most interesting and telling, which you don't see in any other country really, is the number of high-ranking officials that have been exposed. So I'm not really sure how that has happened, but certainly something to be concerned. But the other news about it is that, you know, this week is Purim. So
you sent me the best explanation of Purim for people who don't know. We ought to just send people to that website.
Right. Chabad.org, chabad.org for Purim, P-U-R-I-M. And it's like, in essence, it's a Purim story in a nutshell. But they have, you know, it's a day of great celebration, right? So you have Haman, who's really like a modern day Hitler, who really he issued a decree. He got the king to issue a decree for the destruction of the Jews on a certain day. But little did he know that the king's wife was a Jew.
Well, actually, it was his second wife.
His second wife,
King,
right.
King Antiochus had his first wife executed.
Vashti, right? Because Vashti disobeyed.
Disobeyed the king.
Right.
He had her executed, and then he goes out and searches for a second wife.
Right. So in essence, anyone who is beautiful, all the beautiful women in the kingdom had to be brought into his harem.
That's right.
And she had to go through a year of preparation. So she was a sweet little orphan girl who lived with her uncle Mordechai. And Mordechai told her, he says, no matter what, do not tell them that you are a Jew. And so nobody in the kingdom, in the king's palace, knew that she was a Jew. And out of all the girls in the harem, the king found love with her and made her his queen. And so when this happened, when the decree was issued throughout the entire Persian Empire, which was massive, that on a certain date that the people in the kingdom could kill the Jews, Mordechai went to her and so the whole story, she fasted for 3 days and then she went to the king. The king gave her favor. Ultimately, Haman was hung on his own gallows that was set for Mordechai. Mordechai becomes the second in command in the kingdom. The king gives him his signet ring. He and Esther live happily ever after. And Mordechai and Esther decree Purim, the day that we were able to take revenge on our enemies, because the king and Esther's reversed the decree by writing a new decree saying, on this day, the Jews can destroy their enemies. And it said that fear went out throughout the kingdom, that many people even converted to Judaism because they feared the Jews so greatly. And so we celebrate. So the decree is this, that on Purim, we give gifts of sweet drinks, sweet wine, hamantaschen cookies. It's like you share gifts of food and wine. And you celebrate. It's like a Halloween. We dress up in costumes and we celebrate. It's a big. It's like another big part. Like in Jews, this is what we do in Judaism: eat, drink, be merry. You know.
It's true. But one of the cool things about Purim for bringing young kids into the feeling and the essence of Judaism, as they read the story of Purim, every time Haman's name is mentioned, the kids have this little thing called a Gregor. It's like a stick with a thing on top of it, and you swirl it around and it makes noise.
Very loud noise maker.
but no, I remember as a little kid, going to Sunday school or Hebrew school even, and that was a thing that made me think, well, this is pretty cool, you know?
Did you ever dress up, though? Did you for the parades? How did you do it?
I'm sure I must have at one point. I don't remember. I remember my mom putting on some kind of goofy beard or something. I don't know. But I'm sure we must have in Sunday school.
Yeah.
Did you?
Oh, yeah. And, you know.
You were Queen Esther, I assume.
Well, actually, my niece has been Queen Esther before. I have not been Queen Esther. But I like to get the wigs, like the pink wigs and all kinds of fun things. And the groggers, you make a lot of noise. And I love giving out hamantaschen.
You love the holidays.
I love the holidays. Why not? They're fun.
The thing about Judaism, I think, is it's more a culture than a religion. It obviously is a religion, but being Jewish is a cultural experience, and that's what to me is so attractive about it. There's just a Jewish a feeling.
Mishpocha,
family.
Yeah,
right.
And I brought it up because it's so sad, because in Israel every year for Purim, I mean, there's huge Purim parades where like everybody gets dressed up in costumes, like a big celebration, lots of drinking, lots of little chaims, lots of fun in all the cities. So many of those have been canceled or scaled back because of the virus.
The virus. Yeah. I wonder if that's where Mogan David Wine got, because you talk about
sweet
wine.
Drink, right.
Holy cow. That is
like a sugar rush.
I remember having a sip of that as a little kid going, wow. Yeah, that's
right. Yeah. Right. So, but it brings us to our speaker, our guest today, thinking about the story of Purim, because Joe Lovett, he's a director of many years, has worked on 20 different things, but he was so intrigued by the story of the Inquisition from his rabbi when he was a little boy, when he was being bar mitzvahed. And, you know, and there's so much about this rich history. I mean, Jews made up over 10% of the Spanish population, and just the Inquisition, ultimately, you know, Spain and Portugal, and then forcing them out, and where they went in the New World, from the Netherlands with the Dutch, the Protestants in the Netherlands welcomed them. The Ottoman Empire welcomed them most throughout that, and that would be throughout all of Northern Africa, you know, Turkey and the Balkans, you think Greece. I think one of the largest port cities in Greece had a 50% Jewish population. But he talks about, so the movie is called The Children of the Inquisition, and I'm going to have to watch it like 10 times because it's just so full of information. And I will, you know, like just add this, because I don't think we get to this in the interview, but watching the documentary, what was so powerful about it, you know, you could see the hate, because back in that time, the 1200s, 1300s, 1400s, most people were illiterate. Unless you were, you know, a priest in the Catholic Church, a member of the royal family, or a Jew, you didn't know how to read. And the men and the boys always knew how to read because the boys had to read the Torah. And so what happened, because they were literate and they were educated, and they're always studying the Torah and Talmud, they had great analytical thinking and aspects. And so ultimately they served a lot of times as merchants, the financiers. You see them in government posts and positions, and powerful and wealthy because they were literate and educated. Which is exactly why the Sultan of Ottoman, when Spain expelled them, said, "You are welcome here," because he wanted the merchants and the financiers and those who had that ability to help build his kingdom and sustain it. So really interesting when you think about that, and also how the Inquisition got to the point, like even the conversos, those who had, you know, quote unquote converted, you know, if people who could attack them and challenge them, call them heretics and say, oh, they're still Judaizing and engaging in practices of Judaism at home or whatever. And what happened is that people would be prosecuted, and if that was found to be true.
And sometimes killed, yeah.
Right, they'd be tortured. Oh, the movie goes through the torture, goes through the public executions, which is horrific. But what would happen, the reason why like a lot of them would do it, because they hated the Jews still, because they were so educated and still were successful. And so what would happen is if you accuse someone and that person was found to be a heretic, you would get their property. So kind of similar what happened in Nazi Germany, right? So fascinating interview. So this is part one of the interview.
All right. Part one, Joe Lovett. It was so fascinating. We had to break it up into two. And we will talk about the Israeli election after that, because we can't ignore that. And this is WMNF 88.5. And this is The Third Opinion. I'm Mike Deason.
Loreen Jaffe.
And here's Joe Lovett.
Well, actually, it goes very far back. To 1958, and our rabbi was taking a sabbatical during the year. He was going to be bar mitzvahing me, and he asked if I would wait till he came back. And I adored my rabbi, and I said sure, but I paid attention to what he was doing on his sabbatical. And one of the things he was doing was trying to do research on the descendants of the converted Jews in Spain, of the what we call Marano families at that time. And he came back and he gave a sermon called Totus Catholicus, Everyone is Catholic. And the sermon was about how no one that he approached would speak to him, in Spain, would speak to him about the possibility of their having Jewish roots. And no, they would say, Totus Catholicus, we're all Catholics, we've always been Catholic. And the sermon was about how the shadow of the Inquisition loomed so dark over present-day Spain that nobody could even dare consider their Jewish roots. And we know that so many of the Spaniards have Jewish roots because 10% of the population had been Jewish at one point.
Right.
So, as a young kid, a 13-year-old, I was stunned that anything that happened so long ago could still continue to have an influence on people today. And that sort of wonderment stayed with me. Now, of course, this is 1958. It was during Franco Spain, which is a very religiously Catholic Spain. It was just a couple of years after the Holocaust, and so people understood how dangerous it could be to be Jewish. And it was before Vatican II, because you flash forward just a few years, and Pope John the 23rd establishes Vatican II, and he exculpates the Jews for the death of Jesus. All of a sudden, priests are told to no longer talk about the murderous Jews and how they're condemned for eternity. This is a big game changer in the way the Christian world looked at the Jewish world, or began to look at the Jewish world, because before then, every Sunday, priests would be reinforcing anti-Semitism.
Sure.
So, and then you flash forward to 1992. It's the 500th anniversary of Columbus's journeys, and in Spain, there was a great deal of celebration, a great deal of news reporting and feature reporting about what was happening in 1492. And what came out was very interesting. And that is that the very same week that Columbus's ships were leaving the port of Palos de la Frontera for what would become the New World, is the very same week that the Edict of Expulsion from Isabella and Ferdinand came into effect. And the Edict of Expulsion said that all Jews must either convert or die, or leave, because there was no room in the kingdom anymore for Jews. They wanted Isabella and Ferdinand, who were known as the Catholic kings. They wanted an exclusively Catholic realm, and right. And they started with the expulsion of the Jews even before the Muslims, who they had just conquered a few months before in Granada.
Mm-hmm.
So as the Nina and the Pinta and the Santa Maria are setting off, into the Atlantic, so are coming, you know, all of these other ships carrying Jews to different ports. Some were going to Portugal, some where it was still okay to be Jewish. Some were going to the Ottoman Empire. Some were going to certain city-states in Italy where they were allowed to be Jewish. And their worlds were torn upside down. Many were going to North Africa.
Right.
But what's interesting was that the Muslim lands were accepting Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you say, you know, the conflict between the Arabs and the Jews have been forever, that's just not true.
Right.
They used to find ways to live together in peace. So at this point, you know, I'd been a producer at 2020 at ABC, and then I was there for 10 years, and I'd done a lot of the early AIDS reporting and the investigations into government inaction on the AIDS crisis. And when I'd done a lot of health reporting, other health reporting, I'd done a lot of celebrity stuff, and really enjoyed my time at ABC at 2020. But I opened up my own company, and we've done about like 35 hours of primetime program. Primetime programming, much of it on public health. Worked for HBO and ABC and won many awards. But this idea of this investigation that my rabbi, Rabbi Browder, Bill Browder from Providence, Rhode Island, had been doing stayed with me, and I thought this would really be a fascinating film, and it's time to do it. And so we started to shoot. And, first we started to talk to people, of course. And one of the people we spoke to was Professor Jane Gerber, who founded the Sephardic Studies Department at City University of New York. Mm-hmm. And Jane is very knowledgeable. She has a number of books out. And she said, "Hey, Joe, there's going to be a really interesting conference in Kingston, Jamaica. It's called... the Portuguese Jewish Diaspora in the Caribbean." I said, "The what?" And she said, The Portuguese Jewish Diaspora in the Caribbean. Excuse me. And she said, "There'll be scholars there from all over the world and different people there from all over the world who are interested in this background. Maybe you should come." And I said, well, maybe it's time to actually get going. I'll come with a crew. And so we shot there for a couple of days. And it was fascinating because the Caribbean had a very, very large Jewish influence. And so I got to have a more of a firsthand knowledge of this diaspora and understanding that the multi differences of people who identified as Jews, of, you know, all different races and also in different ethnicities, right. who still consider themselves Jewish. And in Jamaica, you can go to a Jewish cemetery and you'll see, a family buried, and it'll be a man and his wife and his, let's say, five children. And then right behind them are his African wife and their five children.
Wow.
All in the same Jewish cemetery. And, it's really fascinating. Really, really, really fascinating.
And this goes to, I mean, you and I, we spoke before we did this interview. And for the listeners, again, we're talking with Joe Levitt. He is a director. He is the individual who has really put together this film that took almost a decade, Children of the Inquisition, to tell the story of what happened to the Spanish and the Portuguese who were forced to flee the Iberian Peninsula. I think this is so fascinating what you're saying. You know, the diversity of what you're seeing in the population, because, Joe, as you probably seen the statistics, with the most recent DNA evidence that's available today, it's anticipated at least 25% of Latin America, or 200 million people, are, you know, either directly or have very strong Jewish DNA ties.
Yeah. No, they say that 25 to 50% of the early Latin American colonists were recently converted Jews. And this is what had happened. When the Jews left Spain, they figure about 100,000 went to Portugal, where they were allowed to keep their identity for 5 years. But then the king wanted to marry Isabella's daughter. And Isabella said, not as long as you have Jews. You have to get rid of all your Jews. So he told the Jews that he was expelling them. And then when they went to the port to be taken off on ship, the ships weren't there. What they were met with was an army of soldiers and priests. And they were forcibly baptized. And baptism is irrevocable. So as far as he was concerned, he had made his deal with Isabel. He had gotten rid of the Jews. And these people were hysterical. And he said, listen, let's not make a big deal out of this. Just go to church on Sunday and be public Catholics. And I don't care what you do privately. And I will keep the Inquisition from you for 20 years. Mm-hmm. And the deal is that if had been a Jew and you convert, or you are forcibly converted, if you then practice Judaism, you're a heretic and you can be and you can be burned at the stake. So taken by the Inquisition. So so the deal he made is that he would protect them from the Inquisition. So a very odd thing, as I'm told, happened is that so these people they changed their names, they became public Catholics, but they continued to practice Judaism in their homes privately.
Mm-hmm.
And Manuel thought that they would all become serious Catholics within 20 years, and certainly their children would be, but that didn't happen. So this continues like for another 15 years beyond the 20, and then this outward heresy became so rampant that they finally did bring in the Inquisition. And so that was coinciding with the age of exploration, and the Portuguese were going to Brazil and starting the sugar trade and all of that. And so many of the of the converted people found their way to South America. And they had to do it with false papers because Jews or converted, recently converted Jews were not allowed in. So they had to go in with false papers. Mm-hmm. And then many of them continued to practice Judaism secretly there. But the fascinating thing is that we have one of our characters. These stories are all told by the contemporary descendants of these victims of the Inquisition, some of whom have remained Jewish because they went to the Ottoman Empire where they were allowed to be Jewish, and others came from converted families.
And that's part one of Joe Lovett's interview. He produce Children of the Inquisition, which is just a fascinating piece.
It really is. And it's touring the country in various film festivals, and I'm going to push hard to get it to one of our local film festivals.
I'm surprised it's not in the Jewish Film Festival.
I know. Well, we got to see if it's in the lineup. If it's not, we're definitely going to lobby to get it in the film festival next year, because I could watch it four or five times.
I've got to see it. I've seen the trailer. I haven't seen it. Let's take a little break. We're going to be back. We're going to talk about the Israeli elections. We're also going to take some calls. By the way, our number is 813-239-9663. But first, we've got to take a break. This is The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5.
Villador, North Central featuring Steve Alex, Jeremy Glough, Talk to Mark featuring Scott Elliott, Josh Holton and the Love Symbolution, and DJ Steve Zagany. Plus, there'll be a Prince lookalike contest, so pull out your best purple outfit. The Glam Slam takes place at the Crowbar in Ybor, Saturday, March 21st, 8 p.m.
The Third Opinion on WMNF 88.5. I am Mike Deason.
And Laureen Jeff.
And you going to dress up for the Prince lookalike contest? Probably not.
No. Although I do love Prince, but not. Although that would actually be a fun Purim costume now that you say that.
Yeah.
I mean, who knows?
It'd have to be purple.
Yes.
Okay. We did not get to yet the Israeli elections. Which...
Oh, my gosh. So much, right? Happened this week. So, right. So, huge turnout. They actually had the largest voter turnout. So Likud party gained a couple seats. So they actually walked away with the highest number of seats, but still not enough to form a government. Blue and white had a few less than Likud. So I think Bibi Netanyahu needed three. He had 58 seats and he needs three to get to 61 to form a government. And I think, so there's a lot of talk this week about maybe some people defecting, whether it was Yisrael Batanyu or some of the other parties, to come over. Of course, now Blue and White is talking about maybe doing something with the Joint Arab List and Yisrael Batanyu, which is Avigdor Lieberman's party, who lost seats in this election.
That's right.
I think, which, by the way, I just want to say, I said that a couple months ago. I think people are going to hold it against him for not.
But
he lost seats, but Likud gained seats. What happened.
But what Benny Gantz said, who heads up the Blue and White party, is that Israelis have rejected Netanyahu three times. And I think that's a fair statement that three times. I mean, I think, and I've said this all along, there is just a fatigue with Bibi Netanyahu. He is also facing criminal charges that will come up before they can form a government.
Right.
And then there are those who wanted to go after Lieberman with criminal charges for criticizing Netanyahu's party. The acrimony over this election is so high in Israel.
Right. I don't know that I agree with Benny Gantz that the people spoke, because against Bibi Netanyahu because he gained seats in the election.
But if you're the prime minister and you can't form a majority, you know, it's like baseball. Three strikes, you're out.
But the Likud party has never, they've always had to do coalition governments, right? Because it's a parliamentary system. So, but Benny Gantz is even further behind him. So I don't know what's going to happen. They're claiming there won't be a fourth election, that Blue and White and Betanyahu and others will figure out a way to do it. I thought what was really powerful too, it was also the largest Israeli Arab population to vote. And so they've gained 15 seats, the joint list. And I think that just speaks to, again, the democracy of Israel.
Yeah, people that say that Arabs are second-class citizens, they have members of the Knesset. They have members of the Supreme Court. I mean, it's not a majority, but they have a right to elect their own members, and they actually could end up in a coalition government, which would give them a seat at the table and some power. I don't know. If I were king, what I would do, if they can't figure this out, I would eliminate both Bibi and Benny and say, look,
goodness.
We can't, these guys can't get enough. Find some new candidates.
And if you remember, we talked about this last week. Benny Gantz is under criminal investigation now because of his now bankrupt cybersecurity company, Fifth Dimension. So, obviously that's going to be an issue. It's hard to say. Nobody knows if there's going to be a fourth election or not. I think the Israelis are just exhausted.
That's right.
I say it again. I love the fact that for years the Arab MKs were actually encouraging the Israeli Arab population to stay home to not vote, and I'm really pleased to see that there's been a turn in that tide and a shift, and I think it's important. And I think a lot of the Israeli Arabs don't always agree with some of the radical positions of the MKs, and they want representation. So
they should.
Right. And I was really pleased to see them come out in such a strong number and ensure that their voice is being heard. And that also, by the way, sends a very strong message to their members of parliament. That, we want to participate in government. This is important to us, to address some of our issues at the local level, dealing with police and security and schools, et cetera. So I was really pleased with that. I think this is, we still have no idea.
Well, I mean, it's like the name of our show. Two Jews, three opinions.
Oh,
this is a third opinion.
Goodness.
Okay. And we're going to bring in a third opinion now with someone who disagrees with almost everything we say. Our phone numbers, by the way, are 813-239-9663. Clay, you are on the air.
Shalom.
Shalom.
I must say, I really enjoyed the interview. I look forward to the second half.
The guy's really good. The second half is really good. And what I've seen of the documentary, and I just saw the trailer, Lorraine has watched it. It is spectacular.
So how does one access it?
That's a good question. How do you ask?
It's only I think it's thechildrenoftheinquisition.com online, and you can see the trailer and a lot of information regarding it. Right now, it's only available via film festivals because it's being. So that's why I'm trying to push to get it into our local film festival.
Well, we're having a lot of local film festivals now. It's amazing it's not here.
So. Yeah,
exactly. So we would love to get it.
Just seeing it, I will find a way to watch it, and I found it most interesting. I'd like to create some common ground.
Okay.
One of the problems we have is acrimony all the time, and instead of that, let's see if there aren't things we can agree on. And one of them is peace, especially peace between Palestinians and Israel. Right?
You all want that? I think we're all on the same page there.
Oh, good. So. I think one of the impediments to that is something I'm going to ask you a question about, and you tell me why it's not relevant or how it's not relevant. Prime Minister Levi Eshkol, back in September 1967, approved the first settlement in the West Bank by Jewish settlers, despite the opinion of Theodor Meron, the legal counsel of the foreign ministry, the top legal aid person in the state of Israel, who stated unequivocally, "My conclusion is that civilian state settlements in the administered territories contravenes the explicit provisions of the Fourth Convention," and now he quotes it, "the occupying power shall not deport, or transfer parts of the own civilian population into the territory it occupies. Recently, Judge Merrin has written and confirmed that he still stands by that statement. So the problem with peace that I see and the Palestinian people see is that Israel has stolen land and refuses to return it. And any peace plan that's been set forward requires that they agree to the theft of their land that Israel has taken through these settlements. How is that not the biggest impediment to peace?
So a couple things there, Clay. So 1967 was a very unique time. The 67 war when Israel was invaded and attacked and Israel was able to push back against Jordan and Egypt. And at the United Nations and the convention there, Israel wanted peace, agreed to the UN resolution, didn't want the land, just wanted peace with her neighbors and didn't want to be invaded anymore. But you had the famous Khartoum-Sudan conference, the three no's, where peace and a recognition of the right of the Jewish state to exist was said no, no, and no. So from 67 to modern day, there's been a lot that has changed. And Israel at the time was not encouraging. And by the way, that individual, he was just one person with an opinion. But Israel at the time was not...
He's top legal counsel for
Israel. Yes, but he was also one of many people with an opinion on that. Can I answer?
And you said a whole bunch of stuff.
I'm not done responding to everything you said, Clay.
Clay, wait a second. Now, you talked.
I'm not done responding.
You asked for our opinion and let...
No, I didn't ask for an opinion. I asked for you to deal with facts.
I am dealing with facts. And so that was one opinion. And so the 1967 to today, a lot has happened, including two intifadas and other wars. And it's not a simple yes or no issue. But going back to the question of that resolution, I mean, there is a difference of opinion, a legality as far as that. But also the accord says that the parties themselves, the Palestinians and the Israelis, will decide on the land. And you also forget that that Jews lived on that land in 1948 and for hundreds of years before then in multiple communities, and that many of them were returning to their communities, that they weren't new communities in that land post 67. So there's a lot of, it's not a simple black or white yes or no issue, Clay. And so I think by trying to make it something like that, it's a problem. Because if we went back to pre-1949 borders, because the UN articles that you're referencing were, Article 4 was adopted in 1949. Of course, that was after Israel was invaded by five people. And in 1948, that land was part of the Israeli territory. So, you know, Israel could say, well, from 49 to 67, it was occupied by Jordan and the Palestinians. I mean, it's not a simple issue as you would like it to say. And I think that it's not about theft of land. I think that there's a lot of issues there to be had. And that's between the Palestinians and the Israelis.
Am I going to be able to speak?
Yeah, go ahead. Well, but wait. You complain that we don't let you speak.
I asked a very simple question, and it was a simple question. And it was based upon law, a black and white issue. It was based upon an agreement which Israel and the United States and everyone else signed on to. And what I heard was that Laureen, who is a lawyer, didn't ever answer the question. What she did was go on and on for three times as long as I spoke and told us a bunch of things that are irrelevant.
I think the Oslo Accords addresses the issue pretty clear.
I'm sorry. Am I going to be able to speak, or is that the way that this works?
I don't know. Do you have another question for us, Clay? We have other people holding. So is there another question?
I asked you. The settlements are illegal.
Okay, I don't believe the settlements are illegal, and I think the Oslo Accords address that.
Stolen land.
Okay.
From the Palestinians.
All right, thank you for calling in, Clay. We appreciate it.
Wait a second.
Why we can't have peace?
Wait a
second. Have peace because you've got to get the hell off the land you stole.
Wait a second. Wait.
All right.
Clay. Wait, let me say one thing here. When there is a war, as there was in 67.
The Palestinians were the ones who attacked
but
you.
There,
Jordanians, Egypt, all that.
Every, and when there is...
Before you showed up.
Wait a second. Wait, Clay.
There.
Clay. When there is a war, everything changes. It doesn't.
That's exactly what this is about.
Okay, all right, Clay. You're yelling at us, and we've got other callers. But thank you for calling in.
It speaks exactly to that.
Okay.
All right, Clay. All right, we got other calls. Andy, you're on the air.
Is this Andy? No. There's a different one.
I'm Andy.
Yeah.
There he is.
Okay. How are you?
I'm fabulous. How are you guys doing?
Great.
Go ahead. How are you, Andy? So what can we help you with today?
I just wanted to let you know, I know you brought up APAC today, and I want you to let you know how enjoyable it was to be in such bipartisan atmosphere, such a diverse atmosphere. You had Jews, you had Christians, you had blacks, you had Spanish, you had every single type of person there, and every single member of Congress that came to speak, from Steny Hoyer to Mitch McConnell to Chuck Schumer, all of these people were coming and talking about how the Israel relationship is so important to the United States, and it's not a partisan issue at all. And it was such a pleasure to hear that people were just there talking about good things. It was 100% positive. And it was so refreshing. And I just think your audience needs to know about the truth of that, what goes on up there in Washington. And then walking in the halls of Congress, and every single congressperson that we met with was so behind the movement. It's not really a movement, but the behind the Israel-United States relationship, because it really is a bipartisan issue. And it was a pleasure to be there. I just thought your listeners should know about it.
Well, thank you.
Well, thanks.
We appreciate you calling in. You know what? Mike, you and I had some really interesting stories that we didn't get to this week, including the NFL football story, the bar mitzvah story. You want to talk about that one really quickly?
Yeah.
I have so many articles.
Normally, I am not what you call a patriot.
I love the New England Patriots. I love them. I know. They're always hated because they're so good. They win. Everybody wants to root against them. But we have Edelman.
Yeah, is the New England Patriot player Edelman is going to be bar mitzvahed now in the off season, and his
in
father
Jerusalem.
His father was Jewish, and he decided that he was going to be bar mitzvahed, and I think that's a great story.
Right, and it's a lot of preparation for your bar mitzvah. So he's studying in the off season to get ready for his bar mitzvah in Jerusalem. So I thought that was just, I know a lot of people out there love Edelman, and he's such a great player, very inspiring.
I can appreciate his greatness, but. Patriots and Bill Belichick make me crazy.
I know. They make a lot of people crazy. But by the way, I also want to add that Lionel Richie was in Israel this week. He gave a huge performance Monday night in Tel Aviv. The crowd went wild, and I love this. This is a quote from Lionel Richie. He says, "My friends have been trying to convince me to come for 40 years. Now I know why." He said it was just an amazing experience and an international crowd. I just love the fact that he was there, just this amazing performance. So yeah. The concerts that go there, and that's pretty consistent. Anytime a musician goes to Israel, you see these and just such an outpouring. They're like, "Wow, I can't believe I haven't been here sooner. What was I waiting for?"
let me also say one other thing about why the United States considers Israel so important. A lot of people say, "Oh, they just care for the Jews." That's not true. The truth is, it is an area where there is such problems with unfriendly people toward the United States. Israel is a safe haven for democracy, for friendship to the United States, and that is why Israel is so important. It's this little country in the middle of this turmoil-racked area, the Middle East, and without Israel and without the United States being able to have some support there, the whole idea of safety and peace in the Middle East would just evaporate.
Right. And I think also just you forget the benefits of Israel to the whole world. I mean, I think people, the number of relationships that Israel has and is building, not only within the Arab world and the Middle East, but also throughout Africa and Latin America, is just booming. Because Israel does bring so much good to the world, whether we're talking about, you know, cybersecurity, technology, in the medical space, cures for diseases, cures for cancer. We're talking about coming up with now, just weeks away from the virus, to inoculate it, my brain just went blank on the coronavirus, but just so much. I mean, there's so much good that it's bringing to the world.
But we're going to have to talk about it next week because we are out of time.
There we go. All right, happy Purim.
I'm Mike Thiessen.
Lorraine Jaffe.
This is The Third Opinion. Have a great week. See you.
You're listening to WMNF Tampa. Today is Sunday, March 8th, 2020, International Women's Day, and we prepare to celebrate Purim. I'm Joy Katzen-Guthrie. Welcome to the Sunday Simcha.
Esta noche de Purim no duermen los Halloween, haciendo la Halloweenadas para las desposadas. Vivas tú y viva yo y vivan todos los judíos. Viva la reina Esther, que tanto placer nos dio. Vivas tú y viva yo y vivan todos los judíos. Viva la reina Esther, que tanto placer nos dio.